"You're wrong," I cried. "I'm someone else. You've got the wrong man," I say. "My name's not Prescott. Get your confounded hands off me."
"He's English," bawled Omohundro. "You all hear that? The bastard's English, and so was Prescott. Well, you damn slave stealer, I got you fast, and you're going to jail till I can get you identified, and then by golly they're going to hang you."
As luck had it, there weren't above a dozen men in the place, and while those who'd been with Omohundro crowded round, the others stared but kept their distance. They were a very genteel bunch, and Omohundro and I were both big, strapping fellows, which can't have encouraged them to interfere. The man addressed as Jim was hanging irresolute halfway to the door, and Will, a burly buffer and a beard and stovepipe hat, while he laid a hand on my arm, wasn't too sure.
"Hold on a shake, B," says he. "You certain this is a fella?" "Course I'm certain, you dummy. Jim, will you get the goddamn constable? He's Prescott, I tell you, and he stole a nigger Randolph. Got him clear to Canada, too."
At this, two of the others were convinced and came to lend a hand, seizing my wrists while Omohundro took a breather and stepped back, glowering at me.
"I'd know the sneaking blackguard anyway, and his dad blasted fancy accent."
"It's a lie," I protested. "A fearful mistake, gentlemen, I assure you. The fellow's drunk. I never saw him in my life. Oh, he's beastly nigger. Let me loose, I say."
"Drunk, am I?" shouts Omohundro, shaking his fist. "Why, you brass bollocked impotent hog, you!" "Tarnation, shut up, can't you?" cries Will, plainly bewildered. "Why, sure don't talk like a slave stealer, and that's a fact. But see here, mister, just you rest easy. We get this business looked to. And you hold off, Pete. Jim can get the constable while we study this thing." "You, sir?"
This was to Spring, who hadn't moved a muscle and was standing four square, his hands jammed in his pockets, watching like a lynx.
"You were sitting with this fella. Can you vouch for him, sir?"
They all just being against me bleakly and then away.
"I never set eye on him for,"
says he to me,
"him a fight and for drink."
Nor as he turned towards the door, the fiddier wretch, while I took him speedily, not a boot and true, but his fame for.
"She's on with going mints," says Will, "talking and laughing, I see her own self. They get together, nubs, I'm in a t-"
and a hundred nimby into some path.
"Just hear me, says he. "You English, you ain't, and you not call it the bullshit, can prick it, got swear on a bubble with that can the wall there. I reckon you both of you are custom cut. Stand out away."
I'll sing, and the lady's voice at last, like I'll, will get step.
"You are you both, is a hundred and best self. It may be without you, don't do another step. You go stay here, so now. I would feel sorry for old men in the world, please, in the England, play back to in this. But this moment, she hangs in the park, the rat. From you, all this juicy thing, is the third of a man, you'd say, tis a meaning ruler. Among these originalists, while gone out and purple, and that unmasked to his eyes. His hands slowly from his pockets clench. "They are no Yankee pipsqueak," says he, "sir, side of her governor with Sue."
"Yankee!"
roared Mondro. "Why, you, I damn."
The first heart raised on him. "I did boy, wasn't it all my bit hugging cement to throw shit. I wear his stuff, and had been being hit with a hat of bad crit. It was so little G.G. Grace extreme beer, and all the spread to the middle and belly. But no one saw. At prices about a plus or a corrosion. And they, a pillar, God bless her. One shot speaking sang his fist and running on his midf. That has sucked like a burst football, and went flying for a ball. Before we advance, the dumb-mounded Will Buckler, hurled with sneezing swore. I beat them to all of you, roar he, going down at him. One is Gelford, into a pin chair. Sprint and hang, a budging leap, the conscious display. Another go, he had loose costing band. If I'd been wide, I'd have said some. Don't want to ride trust or fee, he ended up railing to her. He was might, after noise pink cloying, I got off him a pat in the other. Done time, living short, some minute holding his head. Flight was of new jet, I got him and came looking for to live that way, but held the luck was in play, aye. Yeah. Wanders on his feet again, chin belly, with Mr. McCarn, red for breath. The fell wheels off top, had a wrong call, which I found and gave him, while my up had in the neck. And I looked, and he fly and burnt on Will's face. Those evenings in the Oriel combination room weren't wasted, thinks I. And then a willowy cove among the onlookers took a hand, shrieking in French, and trying to brain my gallant captain with an ebony cane. Spring grabbed it and jerked, and the cane came away in his hand, leaving the frog holding 2 feet of naked, glittering steel, which he flourished feebly with Gallic squeals.
Poor fool. It was a sudden flurry, the snap of a breaking bone. The frog was screaming on the floor, and Spring had the sword stick in his hand. I heard Omohundro shout as he flung himself at Spring, hauling a pistol from beneath his coat. Spring leaped to meet him, bawling, "Habit!" And by God, he had. Before my horrified gaze, Omohundro was swaying on tiptoe, staring down at that awful steel that transfixed him. He flopped to his knees, the pistol clattering to the floor, and fell forward on his face with a dreadful groan. It was a dead silence, broken only by the scraping of Omohundro's nails at the boards, and presently by a wild scramble of feet as one of the principal parties withdrew from the scene. If there's one thing I know, it's when to leave. I was over the counter and through the door behind it like a shot, into a storeroom with an open window, and then tearing pell-mell up an alley, blind to all but the need to escape. How far I ran, I don't know, doubling through alleys, over fences, across backyards, stopping only when I was utterly blown and there was no sound of pursuit behind. By the grace of God, it was coming on to evening, and the light was fading fast. I staggered into an empty lane and panted my soul out, and then I took stock. That was escape to England, dished. Anyway, Spring's passage out was going to be at the end of a rope, and unless I shifted, I'd be dancing alongside him. Once the traps had me, the whole business of the slavers Cassie had killed would be laid at my door. Hadn't I seen the reward bill naming me murderer? And the Randolph affair at Omohundro would be a mere side dish. I had to fly, but where? There wasn't a safe hole for me in the whole damned USA. I forced down my panic and tried to think. I couldn't run, I had to hide, but there was nowhere. Wait, though there might be. Susie Willink had sheltered me before, when she thought I was an American Navy deserter. But would she do it now, when they were after me for the Capital Act? But I hadn't killed Omohundro. She didn't even know about him, or Spring. And she'd been besotted with me, the fond old strumpet, pipe in her eye when I left her. Aye, a little touch of Harry in the night, and she'd be ready to hide me till the next election. But the fix was, I'd no notion of where, in New Orleans, I might be, or where Susie's place lay, except that it was in the Vieux Carré. I daren't strike off at random with the Navy's bulldogs, and the civil police too by now, on the lookout for me. So I set off cautiously, keeping to the alleys until I came on an old nigger sitting on a doorstep, and he put me on the right road. The Vieux Carré, you must know, is the old French heart of New Orleans, and one gigantic flesh pot. Fine houses and walks, excellent eating places and gardens, brilliantly lit by night, with music and gaiety and colour everywhere, and every second establishment a knock-in shop. Susie's bawdy house was among the finest in New Orleans, standing in its own tree-shaded grounds, which suited me, for I intended to sneak in through the shrubbery and seek out my protectress with the least possible ado. Keeping away from the main streets, I found my way to that very side alley, where months earlier the Underground Railroad boys had got the drop on me. It was empty now, and the side gate was open, so I slipped in and went to ground in the bushes, where I could watch the front of the house. It was then I realized that something was far amiss. It was one of these massive French colonial mansions, all fancy ironwork and balustrades and slatted screens, just as I remembered it. But what was missing now was signs of life, a real life at any rate. The great front door and windows should have been wide to the warm night, with nigger music and laughter pouring out, and the chandeliers a-glitter, and the half-naked yellow tarts strutting in the big hall, or taking their ease on the veranda like tawny cats on the chaise longues, their eyes glowing like fireflies out of the shadows. There should have been dancing and merriment, and drunken dandies taking their pick of the languid beauties, with the upper stories shaking to the exertions of happy fornicators. Instead, silence, The great door was fast, and while there were lights at several of the shuttered windows, it was plain that if this was still a brothel, it must be run by the Band of Hope. A chill came over me that was not of the night air. All of a sudden, the dark garden was eerie and full of dread. Faint music came from another house beyond the trees. A carriage clopped past the distant gates. Overhead, a night bird moaned dolefully. I could hear my own knees creaking as I crouched there, scratching the newly healed bullet wound in my backside, and wondering what the deuce was wrong. Could Susie have gone away? Terror came over me like a cold drench, for I had no other hope. Oh, Christ, I whispered half aloud. She must be here.
Who must be? Grated a voice at my ear, a hand like a vice clamped on my neck, and with a yap of utter horror, I found myself staring into the livid, bearded face of John Charity Spring. Shut your trap, or I'll shut it forever, he hissed. Now then, what house is that, and why were you creeping to it? Quick, and keep your voice down.
He needn't have fretted. The shock of that awful moment had almost carried me off, and for a spell I couldn't find my voice at all. He shook me, growling, while I absorbed the dreadful realization that he must have been dogging me all the way. First in my headlong flight, then on the streets, unseen. It was horrifying, the thought of that maniac prowling and watching my every move. But not as horrifying as his presence now, those pale eyes glaring round as he scanned the house and garden. And knowing him, I answered to the point, in a hoarse croak.
It belongs to a friend of mine, an Englishwoman, but I don't know if she's there now.
Then we'll find out, says he. Is she safe?
I don't know. She took me in once before, but...
What is she, a whore?
Yes, she owns the place, or did.
A bawdy, says he, and bared his teeth. Trust you to make for a brothel. Plura faciunt homines e consuetudine quam eratione. Men do more from habit than from reason. You dirty little rip. Now then, see here. Thanks to you, I'm in a plight. Can I lie up in that ken for a spell? And I'm asking your opinion, not your bloody permission. My answer was true enough.
I don't know. Christ, you killed the man back there. She may not...
Self-defense, snarls he. But we agree, a New Orleans jury may take a less enlightened view. Now then, this strumpet. She's English, you say? Good-natured, tolerant, a woman of sense.
Why, yes, she's a decent sort.
I sought for words to describe Susie.
She's a cockney, a common woman, but she must be, if she took you in,
says this charmer. And we have no course but to try. Now then. And he tightened his grip until I thought my neck would break. See here, if I go under, you go under with me, do you see? So this bitch had better harbour us, for if she doesn't... He shook me, growling like a mastiff. So you'd better persuade her, and mind what Seneca says, qui timide rogat, docet negare. Eh? Jesus, did Arnold teach you nothing? Who asks in fear is asking for a refusal. Right, march! I remember thinking as I tapped on the front door with him at my elbow, brushing his hat on his sleeve, how many poor devils have ever had a mad murderer teaching them Latin in the environs of a leaping academy in the middle of the night? And why me, of all men? Then the door opened, and an ancient nigger porter stuck his head out, and I asked for the lady of the house.
Miss Willink, sir. I'm sorry, sir. Miss Willink gone away.
She isn't here,
huh? Oh, no, sir. She here. But she gone away pretty soon. Our establishment says closed, permanent. But if you go next door to Miss Rivers, she be accommodating you, gentlemen.
Spring elbowed me aside. Go and tell your mistress that two English gentlemen wish to see her at her earliest convenience. says he, damned formal, "and present our compliments and our apologies for intruding upon her at this untimely hour." As the darkie goggled and tottered away, Spring rounded on me. "You're in my company," he snaps, "so mind your bloody manners." I was looking about me, astonished. The spacious hall was shrouded in dust sheets. Packages were stacked everywhere, bound and labelled as for a journey. It looked like a wholesale flitting. Then from the landing I heard a female voice, shrill and puzzled, and the nigger butler came shambling into view, followed by a stately figure that I knew well, clad in a fine embroidered silk dressing gown. As always, she was garnished like pompadour, her hennaed hair piled high above that plump, handsome face, jewels glistening in her ears and at her wrists, and on that splendid bosom that I remembered so fondly. Even in my anxious state, it did me good just to watch 'em bounce as she swayed down the stairs. As usual in the evening, she plainly had a pint or two of port inside her. She descended, grand as a duchess, peering towards us in the hall's dim light, and then she checked with a sudden scream of, "Beecham!" and came hurrying down the last few steps and across the hall, her face alight. "Beecham, you've come back. Well, I never. Wherever have you been, you rascal? I declare, let's have a look at you." For a moment I was taken aback until I recalled that she knew me as Beecham Millward Comber. God knew how many names I'd passed under in America. Arnold, Prescott, Fitz something or other. But at least she was glad to see me, glowing like souls awakening, and holding out her hands. I believed I'd have been enveloped if she hadn't checked modestly at the sight of Spring, who was bowing stiffly from the waist, with his hat across his guts. "Susie," says I, "this is my friend, Captain John Charity Spring." "Oh, indeed," says she, and beamed at him up and down. Blow me if he didn't take her hand and bow over it. "Most honoured to make your acquaintance, marm," says he. "Your humble obedient." "Oh, I never," says Susie, and gave him a roving look. "A distinguished pleasure, I'm sure." "Oh, stuff, Beecham. Do you think I'm going to do the polite with you, too? Come here and give us a kiss." Which I did, and a hearty slobber she made of it, while Spring looked on wearing what for him passed as an indulgent smile. "And wherever have you been, then? I thought you was back in England months ago, and me wishing I was there and all. Now, come up, both of you, and tell me what brings you back. My, I almost had apoplexy seeing you sudden like that." And then she stopped uncertain, and the laughter went out of her fine green eyes as she looked quickly from one to other of us. She might be soft where well-set-up men were concerned, but she was no fool, and had a nose for mischief that a peeler would have envied. "What's the matter?" she said sharply. Then, "It's trouble. Am I right?" "Susie," says I, "it's as bad as can be." She said nothing for a moment, and when she did, it was to tell the butler, Brutus, to bar the door and admit no one without her leave. Then she led the way up to her private room and asked me, quite composed, what was up. It was only when I began to tell it that the enormity of what I was saying, and the risk I was running in saying it, came home to me. I confined it to the events of that day, saying nothing of my own adventures since I'd last seen her. All she had known of me then was that I was an Englishman running from the Yankee Navy, a yarn I'd spun on the spur of the moment. As I talked, she sat upright on her chair in the silk-hung salon, her jolly, handsome face serious for once, and Spring was mum beside me on the couch, holding his hat on his knees, prim as a banker, although I could feel a crouched force in him. I prayed Susie would play up, because God knew what the lunatic would do if she decided to shop us. I needn't have worried. When I'd done, she sat for a moment, fingering the tassels on her gaudy bedgown, and then says, "No one knows you're here. Well, then we can take our time and not do anything sudden or stupid." She took a long, thoughtful look at Spring,
You're Spring the Slaver, aren't you?
Oh, Moses, I thought. That's torn it. But he said he was, and she nodded.
I bought some of your Havana fancies, she says. Prime gels, good quality.
Then she rang for her butler and ordered up food and wine, and in the silence that followed, Spring suddenly spoke up.
Madam, says he, our fate is in your hands.
Which seemed damned obvious to me, but Susie just nodded again and sat back, toying with her long earring.
And you say it was self-defense? He barred your way and there was a ruckus, and he drew a pistol on you?
Spring said that was it exactly, and she pulled her face.
Much good that'll do you in court. I dare say his pals would tell a different tale, if they're anything like he was. Oh, I've had him here, this Omo Undro, but not above once, I can tell you. Nasty brute.
She wrinkled her nose in distaste.
What they call a flogging cully. Not that he was alone in that, but he was a real violent, know what I mean? Near killed one of my girls, and I showed him the door, so I shan't weep for him. And if it was how you say it was, and I'll know that inside the hour, though I believe you, then you can stay here till the row dies down, or...
And she seemed to glance quickly at me, and I swear she went a shade pinker.
We can think of something else. There's only me and the girls and the servants, so all's bowmen. We don't have no customers these days.
At that moment, Brutus brought in a tray, and Susie went to see rooms prepared for us. When we were alone, Spring slapped his fist in triumph and made for the victuals.
Safe as the bank! We could not have fallen better!
Well, I thought so too, but I couldn't see why he was so sure and trusting and said so. After all, he didn't know her.
Do or not, scoffs he. As to trust, she'll be no better than any other tear sheet. We notice she don't bilk at a betting manslaughter when it suits her whim.
No, Flashman.
I see her security in that full-lip and gooseberry eye, which tells me she's a sensualist, a voluptuary, a profligate wanton,
growls he, tearing a chicken leg in his teeth.
A great licentious flesh-trap. That's why I'll sleep sound, and you won't.
How do you mean?
She can't betray me without betraying you, blockhead.
He grinned at me savagely.
And we know she won't do that, don't we? What? She never took her eyes off you. She's infatuated, the poor bitch. I supposed you stallioned her out of her wits last time. Aye, well, you'd best fortify yourself for Soivit Amor Feri.
The passions are in arms, Virgil.
Or I'm no judge. The lady is working up an appetite this minute, and for our safety's sake, you'd better satisfy it.
Well, I knew that, but if I hadn't, our hostess's behavior might have given me a hint. Just... When she came back, having plainly repainted, she was flushed and breathless, which I guessed was the result of having laced herself into a fancy corset under her gown. That told me what was on her mind, all right. I knew her style. It was in her restless eye, too, and the cheerful way she chattered when she obviously couldn't wait to be alone with me. Spring presently begged to be excused and bowed solemnly over her hand again, thanking her for her kindness and loyalty to two distressed fellow countrymen. When Brutus had led him off, Susie remarked that he was a real gent and a regular caution. But there was something hard and spooky about him that made her all a tremble.
But then I can say exact same about you, lovey, can't I?
She chuckled, and plunged at me, with one hand in my curls, and the other fondling elsewhere.
Ooh, my stars! Give it here! Oh, you haven't changed, have you? And oh, I've missed you so, you great lovely villain!
Shrinking little violet, you see. She munched away at my lips with that big red mouth, panting names in my ear that I blush to think of. It made me feel right at home, though, the artful way she got every stitch off me without apparently taking her tongue out of my throat once. I've known greater beauties, and a few that were just as partial to pork,
but none more skilled at stoking what Arnold called the deadly fires of lust. When she knelt above me on the couch and licked her lips, with one silken knee caressing me to distraction, while she slowly scooped those wondrous poonts out of her corset and smothered me with them, well, I didn't mind a bit. "I'll distress you, my fellow countryman," says she, all husky-like. "I'm going to tease you and squeeze you and eat you alive, and by the time I've done, if the coppers come for you, you'll just have to hide, 'cause you won't be fit to run a step." I believed her, for I'd enjoyed her attentions for 5 solid days last time, and she damn near killed me. She was one of those greedy animals who could never have enough. Rather like me, only worse. And she went to work now like Messalina, drunk on hashish. About 2 hours it took, as near as I could judge, before she gave a last wailing sigh and rolled off onto the floor, where she lay moaning that never, never, never had she known the like, and never could again. That was her usual form, any moment and she'd start to weep. Sure enough, I heard a great sniff, and presently a blubber, and then the gurgle as she consoled herself with a large port. As a rule, I'd have sunk into a ruined sleep. For one thing, about our willink would have unmanned Goliath. But after a while, pondering Spring's advice, I began to wonder if it mightn't be politic to give her another run. Proof of boundless devotion, I mean to say. Be flattered, sweet. It must have been my weeks of abstinence, or else I was flown with relief at the end of a deuced difficult day. But when I turned over and watched her repair her paint at the glass, all bare and bouncy in her fine clocked stockings, do you know, it began to seem a not half bad notion for its own sake. And when she stretched and began to powder her tits with a rabbit's foot, I hopped out on the instant and grappled her, while she squealed in alarm. "No, no, Beecham. She couldn't, not again, honest. And you can't mean it, you wicked beast. Not yet, please." But I was adamant, if you know what I mean, and bulled her all over the shop until she pleaded with me to leave off, which by that time, of course, meant pray continue. I can't think where I got the energy, for I'd never have thought to be still up in arms when Susie, of all women, was hollering uncle. But there it was, and I truly believe it was the cause of all that followed. When we'd done, and she'd had a restorative draught of gin, with her head on the fender, heaving her breath back, she looked up at me with eyes that were moist, once they'd stopped rolling, and whimpers. "Oh, Gold, why did you have to come back? Just when I was getting over you too?" And she started to snuffle again. "Sorry I did, are you?" says I, tweaking her rump. "Blooming well you know I'm not," she mumps. "More fool me. I knew I was getting a sight too fond of you last year, but it was only when you gone that I... Here she began to bawl in earnest, and it took several great sighs of gin to set her right. "And then, when I saw you in the hall tonight, I felt such a joy, and I... Oh, it's ridiculous at my age, carrying on like a 16-year-old. "I doubt if any 16-year-old knows how to carry on like that," says I, and she gulped and giggled and slapped me, and then came over all maudlin again. "What I mean is, like I once said, I know you're just like the rest of them, and all you want's a good bang, and I'm just an old, a middle-aged fool to feel for you the way I do, 'cause I know full well that you don't love me. Not the way I... She was blubbering like the ooze in spate by now, tears 40% proof. "No, if I thought you liked Roger in me even more than others..." She looked at me with her lip quivering and those big green eyes aswim. "Say that you really like it with me more, don't you?"
honest, when I caught you looking at me in the mirror, you looked as though you, well, cared for me.
Tight as Dick's hat band, of course, but it proved how right I'd been to give her an encore. If a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing well, and if Susie wants to go with you a mile, gallop with her twain. I improved the shining hour by telling her I was mad for her, and had never known a ride to compare, which wasn't all that much of a lie, and murmured particulars until she quite cheered up again, kissed me long and fondly, and said I was a dear, bonny boy. I told her that I'd been itching for her all these months, but at that she gave me a quizzy look. "I bet you didn't itch long," says she, sniffing. "Not with all them saucy black tails about. Gammon." "One or two," says I, for I know how to play my hand, "for want of better. And don't tell me," I added with a sniff of my own, "that some lucky men haven't been playing hopscotch with you." Do you know, she absolutely blushed and cried, "No such thing, the very idea." But I could see she was pleased, so I gave her a slantendicular look and said, "Not even one?" At which she blushed even pinker and wriggled and said, "Well, it wasn't her fault, was it, if some very valued and important clients insisted on the personal attention of Madame?" "Oh," says I, "and who might they be?" "Never you mind, saucebox," giggles she, tossing her head, so I kept mum till she turned to look at me. And then I frowned and asked quite hard, "Who, Susie?" She blinked, and slowly all the playfulness went out of that plump, pretty face. "Here," says she, uncertain, "why are you looking at me like that? You're not cross, are you? I thought you was just funning me." I said nothing, but gave an angry little shrug, looking quickly away, and she gasped in bewilderment and caught my arm. "Here, Beecham, you mean, you mind? But I lovey, I never knew. Here, what's the matter?" "No matter at all," says I, very cool, and set my jaw tight. "You're right, it's no concern of mine." But I bit my lip and looked stuffed and all Prince Albert. And when I made to get up, she took fright in earnest, throwing her arms round my neck and crying that she'd never dreamed I would care. And then starting to blubber bucketsful, sobbing that she'd never thought to see me again, or she'd never have... But it was nothing, honest. "Oh, gold, please, Beecham. Just one or two occasional. Like this rich old Creole plant who paid $100 to take a bath with her. But she'd have flung the old goat's money in his face if she'd known that I... And if I'd heard gossip about her and Count Vaudrillon, it was bleeding lies, cause it wasn't him, it was only his 14-year-old nephew that the Count had engaged her to give lessons to. If I'd played her along, I dare say I could have got enough bizarre material for a book. But I didn't want to push my little charade of jealousy too far. I tickled the old trollop's vanity, fed her infatuation for me, scared her horrid, and discovered what a stout leash I'd got her on, and had the capital fun of watching her grovel and squirm. It was time to be magnanimous and soulful, so I gave her bouncers a forgiving squeeze at last, and she near swooned with relief. "It was just business, Beecham, not like with you." "Oh, never like with you. If I'd known you was coming back, and that you cared..." That was the great thing, apparently, she was full of it. "'Cause you really care, don't you? Oh, say you do, darling. And please, you're not angry with me no more." That was my cue to change from stern sorrow to fond devotion, as though I couldn't help myself. "Oh, Susie, my sweet," says I, giving her bum a fervent clutch, "as if I could ever be angry with you." This and a glass of gin fully restored her, and she basked in the sunshine of her lover's favour, and said I was the dearest, kindest big ram. Honest I was. Her talk of business, though, had reminded me of something that had slipped my mind during all our frenzied exertions,
As we climbed into her four-poster presently, I asked why the place was closed up and under dust sheets.
Course I never told you.
You haven't given me much chance, have you, you great bully? She snuggled up contentedly.
Well, I'm leaving Orleans next week for good. And what do you think of that? Fact is, trade's gone down that bad, what with my particular market being overcrowded. And half the men vote off to the gold diggings to try their luck. My, we're lucky to get any young customers nowadays. So I thinks, Susie Miguel, you better try California yourself and do a little digging of your own. And if you can't make a bigger fortune than any prospector, you're not the woman.
Hold on, though. What are you doing, California?
Why? What I've always done, managed an establishment for the recreation of affluent gentlemen. Don't you say there must be a million arty young chaps out there already, working like blacks, the lucky ones with pockets full of gold dust, and never a sporty female to bless themselves with, except for common drabs. Well, where there's muck, there's money, and you can bet that in a year or two, Sacramento and San Francisco are going to make Orleans look like the parish pump. It may be rough living just now, but before long they're going to want all the luxuries of London and Paris out there, and they'll be able to pay for them too. Wines, fashions, theatres, the best restaurants, the smartest salons, the richest shops, and the crackiest doors. Mark my words, whoever gets there first, with the quality merchandise, can make a million easy.
It sounded reasonable, I said, but a bit wild to establish a place like hers, and she chuckled confidently.
I'm going ready-made, don't you fret. I've got a place marked down in Sacramento through an agent, and I'm moving the old kit caboodle up the river to Westport next Monday. Furnishings, crockery, misella and silver, and the livestock, which is the main thing. I've got 20 of the primest yellow gals under this roof right now, all experienced and broke in. So don't you start walking in your sleep, will you, you scoundrel? Here, let's have a look at you.
But hold on, how are you going to get there? Says I, cuddling obediently.
Why, up to Westport, and across by carriage to, where is it? Santa Fe, and then to San Diego. Only takes a few weeks, and the thousands going every day, and carts and wagons and on horseback, even on foot. You can go round by sea, but it's no quicker or cheaper in the end. And I don't want my delicate young ladies getting seasick, do I?
Well, isn't it dangerous? I mean, Indians and ruffians and so on.
Not if you've got guards and proper guides. That's all arranged, don't you see, and I haven't stinted neither. I'm a businesswoman, in case you hadn't noticed, and I know it pays to pay for the best. That's why I'll have the finest slap-up banjo on the West Coast going full steam before the year's out, and I'll still have a tidy parcel over in the bank. If you've got money, you can't help making more, provided you use common sense.
From what I knew of her, she had plenty of that, except where active young men were concerned, and she was a deuced competent manager. But if she had her future planned, I hadn't. I remarked that it didn't leave much time to arrange my safe passage, and Springs, for what that was worth, out of New Orleans.
Don't you worry about that, says she comfortably. I've been thinking about it, and when we see what kind of a hue and cry there is in the town tomorrow, we can decide what's best. You're safe here, meantime, and snug and warm and cosy, she added. So let's have another chorus of John Peel, shall we?
You can guess that I was sufficiently pale and wan next morning to satisfy Spring that he could continue to rest easy, Shay Willink. One look at me, and at Susie, languid and yawning, and he gave me a sour grin and muttered, Christ, non equidem in video, miror magis. Indeed, I don't envy, I'm rather inclined to wonder. Virgil. Which, if you ask me, was just plain jealousy, and if I'd known enough Latin myself, I'd have retorted, Fair non semper virit, eh? The spring does not always flourish. Too bad! Which would have had the virtue of being witty, although he'd probably not have appreciated it. Pleasantries would have been out of season anyway, for the news was bad.
Susie had had inquiries made in town and reported that Omohundro's death was causing a fine stir. There was a great manhunt afoot, and our descriptions were posted at every corner. There was no quick way out of New Orleans, that was certain. And when I reminded Susie that something would have to be done in the next few days, she just patted my hand and said she would manage, never fear. Spring said nothing, but watched us with those pale eyes.